This is KUOW's The Record. Welcome. Thank you for joining us. I'm Bill Radke. Here it is, Election Eve, and the polls say, well, it depends where you look. The New York Times forecast gives Clinton an 84% chance of winning. The 538 forecast blog has it closer, 68% chance for Clinton. Fox News predicts 274 Electoral College votes for Clinton. That's only four more than she needs. Here to discuss what happened over the weekend and what we might expect today and tomorrow is CNN's senior reporter for media and politics, Dylan Byers. Welcome to KUOW.
Thank you for having me.
The FBI made more headlines over the weekend. The head of the FBI, James Comey, had said they'd found new emails from Hillary Clinton. And over the weekend, he said the FBI found no problems with the emails. What effect do you think all this has had on the election?
Well, you know, like so many stories pertaining to controversy or scandal, what you end up have happening is the initial controversy comes out and there's a huge hullabaloo and a great deal of attention to it. And in this case, it sort of sacks the momentum from Hillary Clinton's campaign and gives new oxygen to Donald Trump, especially at a point where, if you remember back when this happened in late October, up until then, Hillary Clinton was doing so well that the conversation in some quarters of the media had shifted from will she win to how much will she win by. That changed drastically after late October when Comey's first letter came out. Now, we should note that the race had already started tightening at that point and was inevitably going to tighten leading up until tomorrow.
Why is it inevitable that the race would tighten?
If you look at the sort of big moments in campaigns, there is a lot of, you get a big surge in momentum for the Republican candidate after the Republican convention and then the Democratic candidate after the Democratic convention. Going from there, you sort of, you know, depending on the news and how things go in one candidate's favor or another, you start to see radical shifts in momentum for whichever candidate happens to be faring better than the other. But if you look back at past elections, if you look at 2012, if you look at 2008, and I believe if you look at 2004 too, what you see is wherever those candidates happened to get, either in terms of favorable or unfavorable ratings, that they started to grow closer toward each other in the final days before the election. And usually what that reflects is usually people sort of coming back home, making final decisions, aligning with their party in terms of how they usually vote.
Man, makes you think that was a whole lot of energy in the campaigns that ended up snapping back to very little.
Right. But anyway, so you get now to this, what's happened over the weekend, which is all of a sudden the FBI coming forward and saying the review clears Clinton in the email inquiry. And of course, it's good news for Clinton on the whole, but it doesn't, as her own campaign would say, you can't undo the damage that had been done over the course of the 8 or 9 days during which everyone was making a big deal about it. And indeed, if you look at the New York Times after Comey's first letter, it's blanketed across three articles on the entire front page. If you look at the more recent letter, it makes up just two columns on the front page. So there's a disparity there in terms of how big of a deal we make between the controversy and the resolution to the controversy.
Well, Dylan, in one sense, the head of the FBI told Congress, we're looking into this, and then he reported back and said, we're done looking into it, no criminal charges. How could he have handled it better?
Well, by what we know, he was not trying to play politics. What he was trying to do was, in fact, show that the FBI did not play politics. He didn't want a situation where after, say, Hillary Clinton got elected, we went back and found out that he knew certain things before Election Day and he didn't tell people. Now, on the other hand, there are guidelines for whether or not, you know, what information should be revealed so close to an election day. I believe it's within 60 days, unless you have conclusive evidence about something, you shouldn't be putting out these sort of hypotheticals. The problem is that once he put out his initial letter about the investigation about Anthony Weiner's emails, he made it instantly became political, and I think we saw that in terms of how things have unfolded over the last week and a half.
Was there any way he could have handled it better?
It, you know, I mean, no, is he in a catch-22? Absolutely. And I think just as Democrats, you know, are upset with Comey for coming out with the letter when he did, I think it's also true that Republicans would have been equally upset for him if they had found out that he hadn't come out with the letter. So, look, Comey has a lot of critics. He's probably had the worst 2 weeks in Washington of anyone. But no, this was not an easy situation by any means.
Let's talk final strategy here leading up to the election. Yesterday, the New York Times said Trump's campaign had removed his access to his Twitter account. Does that matter?
It does matter. The story of Donald Trump's campaign has really been a story of, at least in the general election, has been, okay, is he going to pivot away from being this sort of off the cuff, follow his gut, say things that can get him in trouble. Is he going to stop doing that? Is he going to become a more serious, focused candidate? Really, the story of the general election is that he did not do that. At all those points when we thought he was finally going to get serious, when he was going to try and tack toward the middle and be a little bit more responsible, traditional candidate, he never did it. Now, obviously, that's part of his appeal to his supporters, but I think when the history books are written, I think a lot of people will say, given how close this race is in the final days, that had he been more focused, had he been more disciplined, he might be faring even better than he is now. So now, in the final days, they have taken away the Twitter account. He is reading more off the teleprompter at his speeches. And that's working for him. He is more focused and disciplined now than he has been at any point throughout this general election process, to his credit. And that's why you see the Twitter account taken away from him. And I have no doubt that if he had that back in his hands, he might very well do something to shoot himself in the foot.
We're talking with CNN senior reporter for media and politics, Dylan Byers. Dylan, I mentioned at the top how polls are showing Clinton ahead. I remember when Barack Obama ran, lots of people said, don't trust the polls because people will say they're for Obama to be politically correct, but they will secretly oppose him in the voting booth. Do you think we have any reason to trust or not trust these Trump-Clinton polls?
Well, I think polls are always an imperfect indicator of the final result. Now, that said, they're also, you know, all that we have to go on. Mm-hmm. And, you know as well as I do, these things have turned into a nearly two-year process, so we got to have something to go on. The best thing that you can do is look at the aggregate polling, the sort of what we had seen and called the poll of polls, to sort of find an average. And then the other thing you can look at really is where the candidates are spending money and where they're traveling to in these final days of the campaign. That tells you really what they believe the battlegrounds are, the states both that they think they can still fight for and the states that they also know that they need to defend. Now, I will say, I think the polling right now, if you take it all together, if you don't just look at one poll, but if you look at an average of polls, I think it's more or less roughly on point and gives us a pretty decent indicator of where things are going to end up. But you know as well as I do that there are always unexpected things that can happen. We've lived through 2000, lived through 2004. We know that these things don't always shake out the way that we think they will.
Then what's your final bit of wisdom for us before we move on, Dylan?
Well, I would really, everyone's so eager for this election season to be over, but I would really look tomorrow night at what the indications are, not for 2016, but for 2020 and 2024. If you, we're going through a change in the political map insofar as northern states that we have traditionally associated with being Democratic strongholds like Michigan and Wisconsin, given the non-college educated white middle class vote there that has sort of found where Trump has resonated, those could increasingly turn more conservative or at least to toss-up states. Well, a lot of these states in the Southwest, Arizona, even perhaps Texas, that have a stronger Latino vote, Hispanic vote, and then also places like Georgia that have a strong African-American vote and big cities like Atlanta, those could turn blue. So we could really be seeing a realignment of the political map that that'll play out for several cycles to come.
That's how it looks from the point of view of CNN's senior reporter for media and politics. Dylan Byers, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And, of course, listen right along with us on election night here with live results on KUOW Seattle. This is The Record. I'm Bill Radke. More than a quarter of the land in Washington State is owned by the U.S. government. The federal government has more than half of Oregon's land. That's national parks, forests, monuments, and wildlife refuges. What would it mean if the federal government did what many people have been asking for and transferred those lands to the states? KUOW's Emily Schwing reports.
Shortly after a jury acquitted seven defendants of conspiracy in the occupation of Oregon's Malheur National Wildlife Refuge, defendant Shauna Cox told Oregon Public Broadcasting the group's legal fight over federal lands isn't over.
We have a lawsuit against the federal government to prove that that land does not belong to the federal government. It actually belongs to the citizens of Harney County. That's a state issue. That has not anything to do with the federal.
They own a third of America. And that's just too damn much land to manage efficiently and effectively.
That's Congressman Rob Bishop, a Republican from Utah. He chairs the House Natural Resources Committee. Bishop argues the federal government is neither a worthy steward nor an ideal landlord.
And that's why if you can chop it up into smaller areas and allow states and counties who do have the expertise and are there on the ground to make that determination, it can be much, much better.
Bishop was recently in Wenatchee alongside Washington Republican Congressman Dan Newhouse. Ranchers, horsemen, members of the NRA, about 100 people came to talk about federal land management and options to transfer ownership. U.S. Secretary of the Interior Sally Jewell says congressmen like Newhouse and Bishop haven't accounted for the costs associated with federal lands.
They are not inexpensive to manage, and state budgets are not robust, that to suggest that states could do a better job of managing them is not an appropriate argument.
Washington's Public Lands Commissioner, Democrat Peter Goldmark, agrees the cost of managing federal land would become a burden on states.
Clearly, the federal government has the ability to spend the money in this regard, but Congress haven't chosen to direct any significant amount of revenue to really address the forest health problem here in the western part of the United States.
Problems like insects and disease and other things that make forests vulnerable to wildfire. The state of the Northwest's forests came up during a debate between Oregon's incumbent Governor Kate Brown and challenger Bud Pierce in September. Brown told the audience she's found an option that doesn't involve transferring ownership.
Most recently, I signed what's called a good neighbor agreement with the Forest Service that we will work collaboratively to do the thinning and fire prevention work that needs to happen on our federal lands. It's a win because it puts Oregonians back to work in our woods, and it also creates healthy forests.
In order to transfer public lands in the West into state ownership, it would likely take an act of Congress. State elected officials like Governor Brown and Commissioner Goldmark believe it's unlikely. A report this year from attorneys general from 10 Western states casts further doubt about whether a change in ownership even has legal precedent. This summer, the group adopted a two-year analysis of numerous past court cases. Only Nevada's attorney general dissented. Peter Goldmark calls that very affirming.
That's a big vote of confidence to the premise that the federal land is held in trust for the people of the country.
But Goldmark isn't seeking re-election this year, and there's turnover at other levels in land management. Secretary Sally Jewell will oversee the country's five land management agencies only until the end of the year. She says, much like America's political landscape, the fate of its lands, were they to be transferred to states, is unclear.
And it's more likely that they would be sold to the highest bidder and no longer belong to the American people.
But land transfer supporters say those lands could be better managed at the local level. It's a conversation that's likely to continue even beyond November 8th. I'm Emily Schwing reporting.
It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Last month on this show, we were talking about race, specifically whiteness, with Dr. Robin DiAngelo, who does trainings on racial equity around Seattle. She's the person who coined the phrase white fragility. Well, after that interview ran, we got your emails, we got your phone calls, so we invited Robin DiAngelo back. Robin DiAngelo, welcome back.
Thank you so much.
I really enjoyed our talk. The last time you were here, we talked about white.
Yes.
Some white people don't think of themselves as white or don't want to identify that way.
A key aspect of being white is that it's unmarked and unnamed. It's not something that we have to think about.
And we got a phone call about that.
Hi, Bill. It's Joanne on Vashon Island. Love your show. I just wanted to say that I am white. I'm 65, and I never thought of myself as white. Can you believe it? Even though I lived in San Francisco, where whites are a minority, and I lived there for 20 years. But about a year ago, I kind of woke up to being white when I had a roommate who was Mexican-American, and she called me white at one point when we were having a conversation. I was like, what? So we started laughing and having a personal talk about that.
A white person opening up.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's great. I mean, that's the beginning. We need to do it.
I want to play one more phone call for you because you and I talked in our last visit about white Seattle liberals and how they can be hard to deal with when it comes to race. So we got this call.
But I always think when they say, oh, the liberals are like the worst problem because they are so self-congratulatory and but they're not much better. Oh, I think that is a really gross generalization. I grew up in Chicago. My dad, my grandfather, who were very otherwise, you know, very decent men, were both really bad racists. And I've striven my entire life to get rid of that, to shuck that off. And now I go out of my way to treat everyone of any race or any ethnicity or anything just as fairly and as kindly, and as I try to do the best I can with everyone and have no preconceptions or anything like that. And I like to think that I've done a pretty good job of it. I feel that way anyway. And for her to say that and just to lump me with people who, you know, pretend to be, you know, that way when they're not, discounts my own struggles with it and makes me feel like she didn't know me and I wish she wouldn't speak for me.
Why are you overgeneralizing about white Seattle liberals?
Well, in a way, I'm poking at myself because I am a Seattle liberal, and I sincerely believed that exempted me from my larger socialization in the same in many ways that this man just articulated. And on one level, it's if you don't identify with what I just said, then why the defensiveness? Why worry about it, right? If indeed you have no challenges or issues, let it go. However, I would find it very problematic as a white person to say I have no challenges and no issues, that I treat everyone the same. I have no implicit bias. It's just not humanly possible to have no bias.
This was a bit of a theme in the email responses I got. Lisa says, as a white woman and mother, I've studied and made friends of various cultures. Why is it okay to make sweeping generalizations about white people being racist when I can honestly say I'm not?
You could only honestly say you're not if you have a definition of racism that is, it is conscious dislike, and it is not possible to function across fond regard. So if I have friends, I have fond regard, therefore I cannot have racism. It's a very simplistic understanding of what racism is.
Well, if I'm one of those well-meaning listeners and I'm white, why am I racist?
We are swimming in cultural water. And, you know, it's hard in a really short period of time on an interview, but one of the things I work really hard to do in my presentations is make that water visible. And that water is filled with relentless messages of white as ideal, as the norm for humanity. You can't help but internalize it. And it does manifest in unconscious ways. Let's use this example of I marched in the 60s. This is a very popular kind of evidence that a lot of older white people use.
Marching in the 60s, that's putting yourself out there.
Yes. And on the one hand, I want to definitely affirm and say thank you to those people because we needed to do that. We had to get involved. Thank God white people got involved in March in the 60s. And that didn't free them of all the unconscious racism they were probably running when they went down to the South, the patronizing, the condescension, the white savior. I'm sure some of those dynamics were happening. You know, it wasn't this ideal world in which the, you know, pure white people with no racial bias went down to save the black people from those who were filled with racial bias, right? The kind of good whites versus the bad whites.
Are you speaking from experience? Is no part of you a patronizing, condescending white savior?
Ooh, excellent. Thank you. I'm sure that I am in moments. And if you gave me feedback that I was coming across that way, then I would be willing to look at that. I would actually be more likely to look at it if you were a person of color giving me that feedback.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing I want to say about people who marched in the 60s is this idea that it certified them as free of racism for the rest of their lives. It's been 60 years. There's been incredible evolution in their understanding of racial dynamics in those 60 years. I mean, what other kind of situation do you get certified and never have to take another test, if you know what I mean? It's not good evidence. And I will often ask people of color in my audiences, you know, is this evidence that so many white people give convincing? You know, I marched in the 60s. My parents were racist, therefore I'm not racist because I made sure I wasn't. Gary Locke was governor. Is this convincing?
I literally got an email about how Norm Rice was mayor, Ron Sims was King
yes.
County executive, and Gary Locke was governor. And they say, look,
yes.
we're over a race.
That's right. And when Hillary Clinton becomes president, on that day, patriarchy will end,
we're
right?
Over gender, yeah.
No. And actually, I think a white person who's just convinced that they couldn't possibly is really problematic because it's really hard for that person of color to give us feedback.
It sounds like that defensiveness, that frustration that I heard from some of our listeners, you're saying, look into that.
Please, yes.
I got a note from a listener who says, I fear that the left, of which I consider myself, is being ruined by this movement by preaching microaggressions, trigger warnings, and the like. How can we, whites, embrace other cultures if we cannot even ask, where are you from?
I know it's a common refrain, you can't say anything anymore, PC police. And I would really like to ask the person, really sincerely, what is it that you can't say anymore that you wish you could be saying? That's the first thing I would ask. And really, tell me where your life has been limited by these really simplistic characteristics of, you know, trigger warnings and things like that. Those are the extremes. I don't think that they're the norm. We have to be willing to grapple with the impact of our interactions. And where are you from? And the person tells you California, then that's where they're from. And when you follow up, what you're really asking is, what is your race? And if that's what you want to ask, ask it. Ask it openly and directly. Now, I would kind of caution you to kind of examine, why do I want to ask them their race? But the impact of that is they never get to be individuals. They always need to be reminded that they don't fit in. They don't look like they belong. They couldn't possibly be from here, even though they may be fifth generation, much longer than my family, right? So let's ask what we really want to know, but these kind of coded racialized questions convey a message that is hurtful for people. And why not pay attention to that? If I tell you that that question is hurtful and I explain to you why can't you take that in and be willing to reflect on it? Why are you so sure that I'm wrong about my experience?
You've talked about that certitude, that white confidence.
Yes, it's very frustrating to me. I think it's one of the key aspects to being white in this culture is this incredible lack of humility, this incredible arrogance. This is the most complex, nuanced social dynamic since the founding of this country, hundreds and hundreds of years. And in spite of so many white people feeling completely free of racism, we have consistent racial inequity. This society produces racial disparity, and it does it beautifully. And yet, nobody's racist anymore. So we've got to look at, ask ourselves, how is that happening? And I would argue that this narrative, this idea that it's simply a matter of open-mindedness and conscious ill will, and if I have none, if I'm not aware of any kind of implicit bias, then I'm good to go. I would argue that that's what's holding it in place. And that's another key piece to being white, is this refusal to know. On what other topic do we feel so confident to refuse further investigation?
Here's one more. Today's social justice warriors, you're already shaking your head, teach people to hate others based on what they think those others think of them, because I feel bad, it's your fault. It tosses out generations of self-empowerment and replaces it with blaming, perpetual grievance, and self-pity.
It's actually incredibly transformative. I'm saying, look at the society we're in. Look at the structures. Look at the messages. I can't tell you how transformative and liberating it is to start with the premise that, of course, I'm a product of the society I live in. Of course, I have absorbed problematic racial ideas. Of course, I have some degree of racial superiority, and I have some implicit bias. And when I start from that premise, now I can work to identify and challenge those things within myself, rather than spend all my energy denying that anything's going on and feeling defensive and feeling maligned. It's so liberating.
So you don't have to feel miserable. You can start with the humility and forgive yourself and be curious and start there.
Yes. You know, I use the analogy of the sky. I have an opinion on the sky, right? I mean, I've looked at it every day of my life. I like it best at dusk, and, you know, it's really pretty. And, you know, when I was young, I went camping with my dad, and we laid on our backs, and he pointed out the Big Dipper and the Little Dipper. So, you know, I have some knowledge of the stars. Of course I do. And if Neil deGrasse Tyson walks in the room, I'm going to be quiet and listen. Right, I'm not going to say, my dad said, no, there's 9 planets. Pluto's a planet. I'm going to, I hope, engage with the newest thinking, with where we are today in our understandings of cosmology. I'm not an expert on cosmology. And I actually think racism and racial dynamics are as complex. Where is our humility?
Finally, Robin, so we've heard from some white KOW listeners who say, hey, get off my back. I think I'm there. I'm doing okay. I'm well-meaning. I'm trying. If you're saying that's not enough, what can a listener do to do better?
Yeah, the first thing I would say is, how do you know? Right? How are you doing your best? What does that look like? And yes, I'm going to make a generalization here. Usually what that means is I'm a very nice, friendly person across race. That's generally what I'm doing my best means. And what I would say is that is not enough. Niceness is not courageous. Niceness will not get you to break with white solidarity, will not get you to get racism on the table and keep it on the table.
I thought of you on Monday because I got my foot x-rayed, and my radiologist, that was Halloween, my radiologist said something about how some costume he used to wear that you could never get away with today because, you know, it's so politically correct. And I thought of you. I thought, I'm supposed to say something here to my radiologist. I didn't know what to say. I didn't say anything. It's his world, you know?
Yeah.
I'll pick a fight with this guy?
Well, what you can say in those moments, you may not shift your radiologist, but it's also really healthy and important for you, right? To kind of break with that and to take a risk, even if it's just a little one, so that you can go home and feel, okay, you know, I wasn't complicit. And it could be, yeah, I hear you. It's always useful to affirm where someone's at. And, you know, the more I've been involved in this work and heard about the impact, and the more I understand how those costumes reinforce really problematic assumptions, I gotta say, I get it now, or some version of that, right? Or I met someone who shared a story about what it was like for them to see their culture mocked in that way. That's how they experienced it. And I can't tell them, you know, that that's not their experience. But I can never not see their face when I see that costume. It's just changed for me now. So you've connected it to yourself. You haven't said you're a racist, right? But in a very light way, you've kind of injected a little more understanding or knowledge into the conversation. And it'll be a little harder for him to kind of say that without thinking.
You're good, D'Angelo. I wish you'd have been there.
Oh.
Robin D'Angelo studies whiteness, and she came up with the term white fragility that you may have heard, and she co-developed the City of Seattle's Race and Social Justice Initiative Anti-Racism Training in partnership with communities of color. What do you think about what you just heard? Where are you in this whole arc? You can email us, record@kuow.org, record@kuow.org, and give us a call, 206-221-3663, 221-3663.
It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Good to have you here. A big part of our election conversation is focused on trade. Did Hillary Clinton call the Trans-Pacific Partnership the gold standard of trade deals? Was NAFTA truly the, quote, worst trade deal maybe ever signed anywhere, but certainly ever signed in this country? On the trade beat is Seattle Times economics columnist John Talton. Hi, John.
Hey, Bill.
Let's begin with where we are now. How is Washington State doing in the trade status quo?
Well, Washington is a net beneficiary of trade as it exists now. If you want to call it neoliberalism, if you want to call it globalization, whatever you want to call it, Washington State is a net winner. And yes, a big part of that is Boeing.
The entire state of Washington is a winner from trade, or just the Puget Sound area?
Well, the Puget Sound area most of all, but don't forget that we're one of the largest agricultural exporting states in the Union. And so, yes, most of the state benefits enormously, and it's the money made in places like the Puget Sound that supports net taker counties elsewhere.
So we don't have much of this angst and anger over the sucking of jobs out of Washington State?
We don't. It's not to say it's entirely not there. For instance, there's angst among some Boeing workers about the supply chain work that might be done here that is done around the world. But in general, people understand trade's importance to Washington.
And if Donald Trump were to win the presidency, based on his campaigning, which, yes, is not the same as governing, but how would a Trump presidency appear to change the trade status quo in Washington?
Everything depends on the Congress. The president is only one person, but Trump has, for instance, vowed a trade war with China. Now, he's walked it back a bit by saying, no, that's just a negotiating position. But China is our largest trading partner. China is the largest destination of our exports. We, as a state, actually run a merchandise trade surplus with China. And so if he were to implement his policies against China, then that would have huge implications, and they wouldn't just stop with the economy. There are also issues regarding immigration. Washington has benefited from immigrants, including very talented people in the technology sector, and Trump's anti-immigration stance could affect that.
And what about trade in Washington under President Clinton?
Well, one of the big questions that Bernie supporters ask is, is she just going to turn her back on us and go back to supporting the Trans-Pacific Partnership? I don't think so. I think that there is such discontent in the Democratic Party and across into the Republican Party with trade as it is happening now, especially with these enormous managed trade deals. They're not free trade deals like TPP and NAFTA, the way the World Trade Organization really isn't functioning. She will come up with a new kind of approach.
So then what do you think a President Clinton could mean for Washington State's economy?
She would certainly support investments in infrastructure, investments in research, both of which are critical to us. She believes mainstream climate scientist about climate change, and so there would be some effort made to implement the Paris Accords. This is important to slowing the growth of carbon emissions. If we don't do that, we're going to lose our fisheries, among many other things. She would at least continue to advocate for Washington trade and exports. Depending on what the Congress turns out to be, more stimulus, more investment in our future in infrastructure.
John Talton, Seattle Times economics columnist, watching and waiting right along with you. John, thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
Now, I know you've had a burning election question on your mind ever since back in the primaries. At first, it felt like a joke, but you cannot laugh it off anymore. Your Facebook friends won't stop arguing about it, conflicting answers flying at you from left, right, center. The uncertainty, the angst, it's too much. You need somebody to tell you decisively, unquestionably, why do I have to remove a stub of paper from my ballot every time I vote? There is an answer, and you will find it right now on the homepage of our website, KUOW.org. This is KUOW's The Record. The latest election news in our state is that a Democratic state elector says he won't vote for Clinton even if the popular vote says he should. If Robert Satayakam follows through on that, he could be subject to a $1,000 fine. Now, we're pretty sure Washington state will vote for Clinton. Boy, life looks very different right now in Florida, a swing state where the polls are tight again. That's where humorist Dave Barry lives. He and I talked about the election and why Florida is the butt of jokes and his take on Washington state.
It's a fine state, Washington. And I know that Seattle is there. Am I right?
Yeah, that actually is true. That's a myth that is actually true about Washington.
So I think the people are wonderful Seattle Seattle people are wonderful book-buying individuals who buy books with money that they pay for the books with.
Yes.
I've always been a big fan of that aspect of Seattle, and I think it's a wonderful, wonderful city.
So we're the one state that deserves to make fun of Florida?
I didn't say that.
Oh.
I did not say that.
Okay.
I mean, just because you're a fine... Wait, is that the way you look at it? You're a nice state, and therefore you should rip Florida like everyone else? Is that really where you're coming from?
Well, we kind of... I mean, we're in opposite corners, but we have opposite vibes. We do not have... For everybody who doesn't know, perhaps we should paint the picture of Florida. Let's paint the stereotype before you demolish it.
Well, no, I actually sort of agree with a lot of the stereotype of Florida. The stereotype is that first of all we're stupid, which is based on the 2000 presidential election, when all the other states were able to pretty quickly determine whom they had voted for, and Florida had no idea. And you may recall originally they called the state for Gore, then they called it for Bush. Then they called it for Gore again, and then I think briefly William Shatner was in the lead, and then by morning it was just a mess. And we went through weeks of elections officials holding up these ballots that Florida voters had been baffled by, and it turned us into a joke, and we deserved it. And I actually proposed a solution to the ballot problem, which is that since it was a lot too complicated for Florida voters to figure out which hole to punch in the piece of cardboard, that we should print photographs of the candidates' faces on the ballot, and you would vote by poking out your candidate's eyeball. But they didn't take me up on that. So anyway, we got the reputation for being stupid. So, and fair enough, we were very stupid in that election and deserved it. But then it sort of became this endless stream of, Florida man stories. Anything that happened in Florida, Florida. And that where I take issue with that, and I first of all acknowledge that we do have a great deal of weirdness down here. A lot of weird things happen. Here is a statistic. Florida has 6% of the nation's population, but it produces 57% of the nation's weirdness.
So is that right?
That's a statistic, and now it's on the radio, so it pretty much has to be true. My defense is a lot of those weird things and stupid things are being done by people who don't originate in Florida. They come from other states, lots of other states. People flow down here. We're like the Ellis Island of stupid, weird people. And so we're taking on the whole nation's weirdness is what I'm saying.
Since we were talking about the election, we all know about Bush v. Gore indecision 2000. What has Florida actually done about it since then?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. We're not ready. And every day I look at the polls, and every day it looks like Florida is more and more becoming the state again, the swing state, the purple state, the state that could determine the outcome of the election. And we are frankly terrified about that down here. We should give our electoral votes to other states that know how to use them and, divide them up. Give Wyoming a couple, give Delaware a couple. Some of the smaller states that don't have a lot of them. And that way Florida can just, you know, maybe let the people vote down here, but don't count it.
Hmm. We're irrelevant here because there's no mystery about how Washington is going to vote.
Right, you are a stone blue state, and I don't mean stone in the sense of, you know, that you're all high on marijuana, although I'm sure you are.
Mm-hmm, we are.
But yeah, you don't have to worry.
Yeah, what's that like, being relevant?
It's terrifying. I don't want us to be relevant. We were relevant before, and it did not work out well for us, so.
Dave Barry, I think you live in Florida now because it gives you a lot of material. But when you retire from the humor from the humor game, you're coming to Washington State.
Well, is it that boring up there?
Yeah, it's humorless.
Is it?
You need a change. You're going to need a change when you're ready to quit.
Now, is it humorless because why? Because everybody's like a mellow, coffee sipping, thoughtful Microsoft employee. Why is it?
Some of that. Well, in the Seattle area, you know, all states have their parts, right? They're red, they're blue, and in the greater Seattle area, there's a smugness that comes with knowing that you and everyone around you is right.
Yeah, we don't have that disease down here in Florida. We're pretty sure that maybe one of us is right, but that most of us are probably insane and wrong. So yeah, that might get a little boring. So maybe what we could do is have some kind of a population exchange where we send like a bunch of Miami people up there, and you send a bunch of Washington people down here and see how it works out. Probably the problem would be that the Miami people just by the way they drive would kill a lot of pedestrians up there, and the Washington people coming down here would probably not survive Miami traffic. So it might not be a good idea unless we had designated drivers for everybody.
There might be rear window shootouts.
Yeah, would we be allowed to bring our weapons? Because that would be a big factor, I think, on whether or not we do.
What could the rest of us learn from a Florida voter this year?
Well, I think you could learn to be more open-minded. Like, I'm guessing that the typical Seattle voter already knows who he's going to vote for and how he's going to vote and where he's going to vote and that sort of thing. And I think the typical Florida voter is just going to wake up and realize it's Election Day and head in and try to figure out where he or she is supposed to vote. And then trying to, you know, look at the ballot. And based on the fact I've been in line behind these people, probably never realized that there were going to be candidates on the ballot, you know, possibly including for President of the United States. We'll just be deciding that stuff then and there on the spot. That's kind of open-minded, freewheeling people we are.
We actually have an all mail-in ballot. All our elections are mail-in here.
All of it? No polling places?
Right.
Then where do you stand in line? No, you don't.
At the mailbox?
Post office.
Right, at the post office. Yeah, it's a very sober way of doing it, I'm telling
you.
God,
you are a boring state.
So says Pulitzer Prize-winning writer and humorist Dave Barry. There, his new book is Best State Ever, A Florida Man Defends His Homeland. Florida, once again, a swing state in this American election. By the way, not only Americans are riveted by our election day. Visiting us from Canada this week, the host of CBC Radio's On the Coast, Stephen Quinn. Good to see you in person.
Good to see you in person as well. Thank you for having me.
Welcome to Seattle. You were telling me that Canadians are more fascinated with this U.S. election than with any in memory.
Someone has actually polled on that, in fact, and it's true. This election has caught the attention of Canadians in a way no other U.S. election has ever. I suppose partially because of one particular candidate, Donald Trump, who is unpredictable at best, who is considered to be a little bit of a sideshow. And I think people just can't believe what they're seeing coming out of our neighbor to the south and the tone of the campaign. And every time you turn on the television or turn on the radio, you hear something more appalling than the thing you just heard. The other thing, though, is the serious part of it is beyond the curiosity of it is, I mean, we have and you were just talking about it, trade relationship between the United States and China. Of course, the United States is Canada's most important trading partner, and you've got a candidate calling the NAFTA a disaster, the worst deal the U.S. ever signed, saying that it's going to destroy America. That has a big impact on Canada because trade with the U.S. is a very big part of the Canadian economy.
Some Trump supporters say he doesn't mean what he says. How seriously do Canadians take a threat to NAFTA?
I don't know, to tell you the truth, but I mean, I think it is something that, you know, I don't know how seriously you can take anything that comes out of Donald Trump's mouth. And we've tried to have conversations about what would it take to actually back out of NAFTA. Who's going to go to the Ford Motor Company and say, you know what, you can no longer manufacture cars in Mexico. We're sorry, you're going to have to shut that plant down. It doesn't seem possible that you could roll it all back, but it he's saying it, and I think that's what's worrying people.
You talked about the sensationalism of it all. Some Americans say they're embarrassed by Trump's popularity. Are Canadians looking down at us? Have you learned something about us that you didn't know before?
I don't think so. But what we've seen is we've seen him tap into something that was clearly always there, that the division that's been exposed through this. I mean, I don't think we've ever seen in recent memory the country more divided than it is now. I don't think Canadians are looking down on Americans. I think we're trying to figure out what is going on and what led to this, and maybe being sympathetic to what Americans are going through right now.
Does Canada have no significant version of this? Angry undercurrents about the economy or immigration or identity or race?
It's interesting because before the last federal election, which was just over a year ago, the Conservative government, which was the previous government of Canada under Prime Minister Stephen Harper, tried to foment some of this in the election. There was a big debate about the hijab, about the face covering worn by some Muslim women, and it ended up being a really divisive issue. It was a miscalculation, I would suggest, on the part of the Conservatives, because they got trounced and Justin Trudeau's Liberals won a majority government when it was supposed to be a close election. So the province of Quebec has gone there as well on its own. But using that issue to divide people backfired big time. And Canada, I mean, like the United States, but I think we're particularly conscious of it, is we're a country built on immigrants. We're a country built on immigration. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's talking about stepping up immigration to get more people into the country. We've taken more than 30,000 Syrian refugees into the country, and we're a tenth of the size of the United States.
How do Canadians think a Clinton presidency would affect them?
I think they...
We're talking for an entire nation here, I realize, right. But in general.
No, I'll speak for all of Canada.
Okay,
I have no
please.
Problem with that. I think that the thinking is that it would offer some stability. The unpredictability of Donald Trump, I think, is what scares people. You know, I've heard from a lot of people here who have voted for Hillary Clinton that they say, you know, she was...
Here in Seattle?
Yes. She was the president's wife. You know, she watched him do his job for 8 years. She has been, of course, Secretary of State. You know, she knows how government works at the state level, at the federal level. You know, she's demonstrated competence. I think a lot of Canadians feel the same way, which is it'll be closer to the status quo than what we have now. And I also think that a lot of Canadians, you know, we see Obamacare as something getting close to our universal health care system in Canada. I mean, we shake our heads and wonder how a country as rich and as powerful as the United States can't have some sort of guaranteed health care for its citizens. And Hillary Clinton is seen as somebody who would continue that, I think.
Some Democrats are saying, shh, we try to keep that on the down low.
Yeah.
You are, by the way, I'm talking with the CBC Radio's On the Coast host, Stephen Quinn. You are doing your show from Seattle today. And what do you want to accomplish in today's show?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for lending us your studio downstairs. We appreciate that greatly. We wanted to be on the ground here because watching it from across the border isn't the same as being in the middle of it. And so I was down here on Friday. I did a number of interviews on Friday that we're going to hear this afternoon. And we're bringing in recent graduates from the University of Washington, Washington State University as well. We're going to talk to a Muslim blogger. We're going to talk to a political historian to sort of put this all in context for us. And we tried to tap into, to get away from the Hillary versus Donald thing. We're talking about national responsibility when it comes to affordable housing. We're talking about exports with the workers at the Boeing plant, which I visited on Friday. We're talking about all kinds of, you know, actual real issues, seniors, Social Security, the Affordable Care Act, trying to tap into what people actually care about that isn't Hillary or Donald.
We just have a few seconds, Stephen. Did any of the people you talked to in Seattle say they're about to be your neighbors if their favorite candidate loses?
They absolutely did. And I keep telling them that it's not a water park. You can't just come. But a lot of people are convinced that's where they're headed.
Stephen Quinn, host of CBC Radio's On the Coast, maybe your future neighbor. We've talked with him before on The Record, and it's good to have you here in person. Welcome to Seattle.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having us.
It's The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information.